The Greater Fool presents The Sinatra Suite, Part 2, Barefoot in Vegas. When a person falls in love, the rest of the world loses its claws. Life's aggravations become more tolerable, whether it's a disconnected phone or a parking ticket or waking up in the morning to find your apartment burglarized. "Three people asleep in the living room last night," I said, "and not one of you wakes up while someone breaks in and rummages through our things?" "I did wake up," Frank said. "I thought it was you carrying the TV out the door. I asked where you were taking it, and you said to the repair shop, so I went back to sleep. Jesus, give me a break." Evidently, Frank had been duped by the same mind trick the Grinch used when he stole Christmas. Under normal depressive circumstances, I would have screamed at him, but my blooming long-distance romance with Kate had cast an optimistic glow over everything. Besides, it was hard not to see the humor in the situation, especially in the misfortune of the burglar, who couldn't have picked a worse apartment to rob. I imagined the feeling of defeat as his flashlight scanned over sleeping bags and plastic lawn chairs. "Daddy hit the jackpot tonight, boys," he'd say afterward. "Let's see. Antacid pills, a digital alarm clock, a pack of Marlboro lights." The mother load was a Ziploc sandwich bag filled with coins, also known as my change receptacle. "They must have been looking for a wall safe," Frank said, examining the Reservoir Dogs poster that lay curled up on the living room floor. "Yeah," I said, searching the bathroom for the toothpaste tube, which had apparently been stolen as well. These guys were professionals. As it turned out, the only missing item of any value was the television, and that was a minor inconvenience. The five of us had already planned on upgrading to a color set, possibly one with a 19-inch screen, depending on the price. In that regard, the burglary was a blessing in disguise, forcing us into the nearest Kmart the following day, where we picked out the cheapest, standard-definition color TV in stock. That evening, in our nightly phone call, I told Kate about the robbery. "My God, you must be scared shitless," she said, tipsy after a Sunday night out with the girls. "Mostly I'm pissed I forgot to set the alarm," I said, substituting "set the alarm" for "close the window." "The Dutch lambskin sofa, the crystal end tables, the rear projection television, all that stuff is replaceable. Everything except for the chestnut humidor that Jack Nicholson gave me. Still, it'll take months for the insurance claim to go through. In the meantime, I'll be living in a hovel." Another blessing in disguise. Earlier in the week, I'd offered to fly Kate out to Los Angeles for President's Day weekend, and she accepted. I had fretted about the condition of my apartment, the secondhand furniture, the man living in my closet, and I wondered how I'd be able to put a good face on it. The robbery did just that. There was no limit to what the burglars took. Chandeliers, a baby grand piano, chinchilla bathrobes, hell, maybe even an entire patio garden, brick and all. "Bastards," I said. "Somewhere out there, a degenerate junkie is reading my original manuscript of The Sun Also Rises." I sniffled. "You better enjoy it." Now that I had a valid excuse for living in squalor, I focused on my roommates. Kate believed I had only one, which meant the others would have to get lost for the entire three-day weekend. Howie offered to stay with his new friend, Butterfly, who lived in a motel on Hollywood Boulevard. "It could be weird, though," he said. "We're sort of in that gray area between platonic and romantic." If that didn't work out, he cited both the beach and the downtown bus terminal as viable options. "Worst case, I can always stay at that crack house on Slauson," he said. "The important thing is that you make a good impression on this girl." Graham wasn't as flexible. Although he'd been working at a movie theater for the last month, he wasn't comfortable asking his coworkers if he could stay with them. He said they hadn't yet welcomed him into their clique. That clique, of course, being high school. After some debate, I convinced him that living out of his Dodge Caravan would be the safest bet, so long as he parked on a quiet residential street and hid inside his sleeping bag at night. I suggested a cul-de-sac off of Argyle, mainly because of the nearby donut shop with the public bathroom. That left Frank and Eric. Since his name was on the lease, Eric technically had the right to stay, but he was the only one with friends outside of our apartment, and, as luck would have it, one of them asked if he could house-sit that weekend. So by default, Frank would be my sole roommate when Kate arrived. This also worked in my favor, as he'd just started a new job as a line cook at the Sunset Marquee Hotel, where he'd be for all three nights. "I'm sure you'll get to meet her," I said, "and when you do, let's not say line cook. How about sommelier, or perhaps board member? That would really help us both out. With my apartment and roommate situations under control, I bought Kate's plane ticket, made possible by my $700 Christmas bonus. Even on short notice, I got a great fare, thanks to 3 layovers and a departure out of Portland, Maine. Logan is absolute chaos. Flying out of Portland is much easier, I said, neglecting to mention the 2-hour drive to southern Maine or the connections in Pittsburgh, Little Rock, and Tucson. I figured as long as she got here in one piece, I could blame any travel inconveniences on the airline. 3 layovers, I'd say, on the drive from LAX. Damn union strikes. I paid for a direct flight in a first-class seat. I don't think the plane had first class, she'd say. At which point I'd sigh, then remind myself, aloud, to fire my new assistant. I was nervous on the way to pick up Kate from the airport, but as soon as she walked into the gate, I felt at ease. When she saw me, she ran into my arms. "I'm finally here," she said. We hugged for a while, then I took her suitcase. "My Acura's in the short-term parking lot," I said, referring to my car by its manufacturer. This was one of the many tactics I'd employed to improve my decorum. Having grown up outside Detroit, Kate was impressed by the car culture of Los Angeles. After 5 minutes on the road, we saw several Porsches, a few Bentleys, a 67 Shelby, and 2 Lamborghinis. On La Brea, a black Ferrari Testarossa sped past us and blew a red light. "Whoa," Kate said. "You think that was someone famous?" "Probably," I said. I turned to her and smiled, then hit a button on the console, retracting the moonroof of my 92 Acura Integra. We took the scenic route home, heading west on Sunset, cutting up Laurel Canyon, and then doubling back on Mulholland. We parked at a turnoff on the side of the road, looking out at the basin of Hollywood at night, and had our first kiss. "This is perfect," she said, leaning against my shoulder. "It's just the beginning," I said. "I've got a whole weekend of fun activities planned for us." The first fun activity was getting stoned on my futon in front of the TV. "Yippee," Kate said as I handed her the pipe. She took a hit. "Promise me we're going to go out and do things, though. I don't want to sit in here and smoke weed all weekend." "Of course we'll go out," I said, holding my hand out for the pipe. Before long, she was curled up next to me with her eyes closed. "I knew I'd see you again," she purred into my ear. I yawned and covered us both in a blanket, which I quickly removed once I caught a whiff of it. It smelled like pus, the same sickly odor as Frank's knee brace whenever he took it off and left it on the coffee table. I turned the TV volume down, and the room eventually faded out. An hour later, I woke up, disoriented, still sitting upright on the futon, holding the pipe in one hand and the lighter in the other. I wiped a trickle of drool from my chin. As the room came into focus, I noticed a rerun of Cheers on the new color TV and then heard a slow, rhythmic sawing noise. It was Kate, snoring, her head tilted back and her mouth hung open. It wasn't the hearty kind of snore that indicates a deep, restful sleep, but more of a guttural wheeze, like a dying alien struggling to breathe after crashing its UFO on a smog-ridden planet. "Kate," I said, shaking her gently. She twisted away and curled up on the other side of the futon. I looked at the clock. It was 9:45. I tried waking her again, but she slapped my hand away and mumbled what sounded like, "Fuck off, Tommy." I let her be, smoked some more weed, watched an episode of Law & Order, and went to my bedroom. When I awoke the next morning, Kate was in the kitchen eating breakfast. "God, I'm starving," she said, standing before the open fridge, a takeout container of week-old Italian food in her hand. "So, what are we doing today?" she said, her other hand holding a clump of cold linguine. "I thought we'd spend the afternoon in Santa Monica, hang by the pier, get lunch, you know, whatever." "Ooh," she said. I'm pretty sure she meant cool, but her cheeks were packed with chicken parm, making it hard to form consonants. I gave her a quick tour of the apartment, showing her where everything used to be before the robbery. "The mid-century teak armoire stood right here," I said, pointing at the corner of the living room, normally reserved for Graham's air mattress. "They even ripped the antique sconce right out of the wall, left a gaping hole, hence the Pamela Anderson calendar." "Where's Frank?" she said, gesturing toward his bedroom. The door was wide open and the room was empty. "I don't know, he must have gone out after work." Kate poked her head into the room. "Why are there 2 beds in here?" She looked back at me, her head tilted. "Does he share a room with someone?" Blood rushed into my stomach. No, he just likes to have 2 beds. Sometimes he sleeps on one side, sometimes he sleeps on the other. He's eccentric. Kate stared at me, her head still cocked to one side, and said nothing. We spent the afternoon in Santa Monica, sparing no expense. I dropped $30 on parking, $75 on lunch and drinks, and another $20 on some amusement park rides. I have a catastrophic fear of heights, but Kate wanted to go on the Ferris wheel, so I obliged. Once the ride started, she sensed my anxiety and asked if I was okay. "Me? I'm fine," I said, my hands clutching the sides of the car, my neck rigid, my eyes plastered shut. I knew that in reality we were moving as fast as a baggage carousel, but I still couldn't dispel the image of the wheel coming off its axis and rolling slowly into the Pacific Ocean. Every time I heard a creak, I'd tense up. "Does that sound normal to you? Oh, Jesus, we're moving backwards now." When the ride stopped and our feet hit the ground, I felt a sense of pride and accomplishment. "I did it," I said to myself, holding my head high as we walked past the line of senior citizens and grandchildren waiting for their turn to board. A pleasant-looking white-haired woman smiled at me, and I smiled back, a reassuring smile, the kind that says, "It's okay. You have nothing to fear." Afterward, Kate and I sat on the edge of the pier eating ice cream cones, our feet dangling above the breakers. We talked about high school mostly, things like sports, the prom, best friends, keg parties. Kate had a high school sweetheart named Brian Lappin, who still lived back in Bloomfield and worked for Ford. "He was my first love," she said, and I could tell by the way she said it that there hadn't been another since. The drive back to Hollywood was quiet but nice. Kate suggested we lie down for a nap when we got home and then stay in for the rest of the night, maybe rent a movie and order Chinese food. It was as though she read my mind. I turned onto Sunset, passing the Whiskey A Go-Go, Tower Records, the Chateau Marmont, the Mondrian. For the first time since I moved here, I felt like a piece of the city belonged to me. Just a little piece, but still. The next morning, we got breakfast at the 101 Diner on Franklin. Kevin Spacey sat in the booth next to us. He wore sunglasses and a name tag stuck on his t-shirt that read, "Hello, my name is With Satan written in underneath." "Is that his son?" Kate asked, referring to the 20-year-old boy in the leather jacket sitting across from him. The server dropped off our breakfast. "Okay, pal," Kate said. "It's Saturday. Can you finally tell me what our big surprise plan is for tonight?" "Vegas," I said, grinning at her over my French toast. "Vegas? I thought we were going to an award show or something. That's why you wanted me to bring the dress." "But Vegas is awesome." "Vegas!" she shouted, adding a little woo-hoo at the end. Some of the nearby diners looked our way, including Spacey, who just shook his head. We hit the road at 1 o'clock and arrived in Vegas just before sunset. Once we merged onto the strip, Kate stuck her head out the passenger side window to get a full view of the epic resort hotels. The Mirage, the MGM Grand, the Luxor, the Bellagio, Caesar's Palace. "Which one are we staying at?" she said. "It's just a little further up the road." 10 minutes later, we pulled in front of the Tropicana, which in 1999 was owned by the Holiday Inn. "This is my favorite place," I said to Kate as the valet attendant parked the Acura. "It's original. All the mob guys used to meet and do their business here." I kept talking, but Kate had stopped listening. She had wandered down the driveway and was staring at the sparkling, distant lights of the strip. "Frank and Sammy and Dean used to play here every Saturday night back in the 60s, I said as we got off the elevator on the 7th floor. "In fact, our room, 704, is where Sinatra himself used to stay." None of that seemed to impress her, which was unfortunate because I'd been preparing that lie for 2 weeks. The truth was that the Tropicana had the cheapest available rate while still being technically on the strip. $329 for one night, more than I paid for Kate's plane ticket. "Sinatra liked the hallways dark like this," I added, referring to the burnt-out light bulbs along the wall. Our room was small and musty. It reminded me of the beach house my family rented for a week every summer, specifically the guest bedroom that my sisters and I were afraid to sleep in. The bedspread was threadbare cotton, a faded turquoise color, with tears in it that looked like pantyhose runs. It wasn't the plush kind of blanket you'd curl up in naked after sex, but rather something you kept in the back of your closet to dry off wet animals. "Let's check out the view." I opened the blinds, rested my hands on my hips, and marveled at the flickering lights, which, it turned out, was the control panel of the hotel's ventilation system. Kate and I lied in bed, watched TV, and fooled around for a bit, then got dressed for dinner. I'd made a reservation for 8:30 at Ruth Chris Steakhouse. Kate looked gorgeous in makeup, a black cocktail dress, and heels. I had on the dark gray Banana Republic sport jacket and slacks that my sister bought me as a graduation present, but I forgot to pack my dress shoes, so I had no choice but to wear flip-flops. Everything was fine down to my ankles. Luckily, my feet were so pasty white that they could have been mistaken for saddle shoes, the kind with five gangly toes hanging off the tips. Still, with Kate beside me, my confidence was high. "Hold up," I said once we got to the lobby. "Let's hit a couple tables first." I sat at a blackjack table while Kate stood behind me, leaning against my shoulders. On my first hand, I split a pair of aces. "Looks like you've played this before," Kate whispered into my ear. I smiled, raising only the corner of my mouth. The dealer beat me on both hands, and I quickly lost the next two games. I laid down another $100 and lost that in 7 minutes. I sulked for the entire cab ride to the restaurant. After the $200 I blew at blackjack, I had $190 left in my bank account and about $130 available on my credit card. "What's wrong?" Kate said. "Nothing. My feet are just cold." The maitre d' overlooked my flip-flops and sat us without incident. Once I got the check, however, I wished that he had refused us service. The bill was $180 with tip, and that didn't even include bread rolls. I intercepted the server on his way to another table, handed him both my debit and credit cards, and asked him to please make it work. After dinner, Kate and I walked down the strip, arm in arm. We stopped in front of the Bellagio and kissed while the fountain sprayed behind us. Other couples strolled around the area, holding hands and posing for pictures. I felt a kinship to them. The loneliness of LA seemed like a distant memory. "Let's go back to the hotel," Kate said, tugging on my lapels. My heart raced. A cab ride would get us there quicker, but I thought it might be more romantic and cheaper to walk the remaining mile and a half. It was a nice idea, but after a block, my right flip-flop broke, forcing us to hail a taxi. Kate flagged it down while I hopped along behind her. Back at the Sinatra Suite, Kate and I took our clothes off and got into bed. There was no radio, so I turned on the TV for ambience. We made out to Pat Robertson's opening statement on the 700 Club. Things escalated quickly, but thanks to my bowel disease, I had to call a timeout and use the bathroom. I felt a sharp pain in my abdomen, which could have been gas or something more serious. Either way, the only solution was to open my escape hatch as soon as possible. In the likelihood that the discharge would be loud, I turned up the volume on the 700 Club. For 10 minutes, I sat on the toilet and strained with no relief, all while listening to stories of God performing the miraculous. By the time I returned to bed, Kate was snoring. The next morning, we packed our bags and went down to the breakfast buffet. I was starving, but the line stretched out into the lobby, so we skipped it and checked out. Outside, the valet attendant pulled up with the Acura. He waited by the door as I got behind the wheel. "I tipped the guy last night," I said, and drove away. We stopped for gas outside the city limits. "Wait," Kate said from the passenger seat. "Let me pay for this. You've paid for everything so far." She searched her pocketbook and handed me a $10 bill. "Thanks," I said, staring out at the endless desert highway that lay ahead. For 2 hours, neither of us spoke. Kate stared out of her window, her head resting on her fist. Once we got to Barstow, I asked what she was thinking about. "Us," she said. "I had an amazing time this weekend. So what happens now? Long distance?" "I can't do that, Danny. I tried it with Brian when I left for college, and it destroyed us. Not just our relationship, but our friendship. It turned us into monsters." She turned to me, her eyes watery. "But I just can't go home and pretend you and me never happened either. It's been almost 6 years since Brian, and I haven't felt this comfortable with anyone. Do I just get on a plane tomorrow, say goodbye, and wait another 6 years for someone else to walk into my life?" I took a deep breath. "I've been thinking the same thing," I said, "and I don't know the answer either. But we don't need to figure it out right now. Let's just enjoy the ride." Kate wiped away her tears and nodded. "Just promise me we won't turn into monsters." "I promise," I said. Kate leaned over and kissed my cheek, then returned to her perch by the window. Only now she was smiling. I knew this conversation was coming, and I had already prepared the appropriate soundtrack. I took the CD out of its case, slid it into the deck, skipped to track 7, and hit play. It was Love Walks In by Van Halen from 5150, the band's first album with Sammy Hagar on lead vocals. Kate put her hand over mine. The Acura roared down Interstate 15. For our last night together, I took Kate to a Japanese restaurant in the Hollywood Hills, spending $90 of my remaining $100. We kept it light, avoiding talk of the future, but my mind had already begun plotting an exit strategy. 2, maybe 3 months at most, and I was out of LA. Before this weekend, I was just another showbiz bottom feeder, shuttling along the freeways, eating fast food, going to the Beverly Center once a month for a new shirt. But after 3 days with Kate, I felt reborn. My desire to be with her was matched equally with a blistering hatred for this town. So what if I threw away a career in the movies? The real thing sat across from me, in the flesh. And to have it, all I had to do was pack up the Acura and take a nice long drive home. We went to sleep early that night. The next morning I woke up to the sound of the shower running. Kate's suitcase was packed, standing upright in the hall. An hour later we were in the Acura, heading south on La Brea. Back to LAX. "I'll call you when I land," she said in the terminal. She gave me a long hug, but no kiss. I wished her a safe flight. She wiped her eyes, thanked me for a wonderful time, then turned and walked to the gate, pulling her suitcase behind her. I watched her yellow blonde head disappear into the crowd, and I thought of something she said on our drive back from Vegas. It turned us into monsters. A shooting pain rose up from the pit of my abdomen, the same one I felt back in the Sinatra suite. I turned around and walked back to the Acura. That concludes part 2 of the Sinatra suite. Stay tuned for part 3, which is yet to be titled, due out in 3 weeks. Thank you so much for listening, folks, and have a wonderful President's Day weekend. Sincerely yours, The Greater Fool.